we decided that it was a beautiful day and we can take a little poke around the harbor.
So moved.
And then we've had lots of blocks and conversations about traffic impact studies, so we are going to have a review of the traffic impact study process. What? Oh, yes, we need to vote on the minutes, absolutely. You have a motion and a second, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any conversation or changes? Ayes have it.
And, you know, Mayor, by way of introducing number two, you know, there was some discussion about recent projects and whether things like beach traffic volume should be included in analysis, and it just seemed like with the array of projects we have coming one after another, and the work that goes into it with Brad and his team from the transportation department, it seemed like a good time and a good opportunity to go through the impact review process in transportation. So Brad has a presentation.
Thank you. Well, we know it's complicated and we know y'all do a great job, but we'll make sure everybody understands it.
That's number three.
Should we turn off the lights?
We can do that. Maybe half of them at least.
Tell me when.
Other half. Everybody good? All right.
Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning.
As Eric said, I think there has obviously been a good discussion about traffic impacts and how we do studies. And, so it's probably good just as a really a refresher for what we're doing currently. And I'll also say that, as you recall, last year we started the process of revamping our analysis process. We're going to get away from this QRS model we have. It's very data intensive. We're going to move more towards live data that we're going to be collecting that's available. That it's the same data, that metadata that you get on Google when you're looking at a phone saying, what is the traffic right now? So we're really going to be trying to tie that into our review process and how we determine when transportation projects are needed. So let's get started here. I'll start a little bit. We're going to talk about the thresholds, we're going to talk about some standards, and then just really get into the process that pretty much every impact assessment goes through. So by our own ordinances, the purpose of an impact study is to evaluate a major project's impact on transportation facilities. Now, a major project is defined by really the amount of peak hour trips that that project is proposed to generate. And in our planning ordinances, we have residential land uses generating over 75, if it's only residential, over 75 peak hour trips, whether that's AM or PM. 40,000 square feet of commercial, non-residential, generating over that 75 peak hour threshold. And then any combination of both residential and anything more than the 40,000 that generates over 75 trips. And we also have, this is not a threshold for a new trip, or for new development as we see here, but for redevelopment projects, pretty much the same thing. It's the net gain that you have in the trips over the existing land use. If it triggers over 75, then we do an impact study for that also. In a very general sense, what we do in the department ranges in levels of study from the CHATS model that you hear about, that type of long-range transportation planning that you use 20-25 year horizon to look out, all the way down to an impact study we talked about. So, and this is really just the spectrum of study that you can have in any kind of facility, where the long range plan is really looking at what is your capacity need and where that network's located geographically in the town. So you're just trying to match up network and capacity with your growth areas. You can do interim modeling. That same process, we're using that long-range model at a shorter horizon. We work for 5 to 15 years. We recently did that a couple years ago, if you recall, when we tried to evaluate what we call the North Area Transportation Projects and get a priority for those projects. We utilized the model to do that, to try to evaluate the benefits of those projects. So that was more of an interim level planning tool. And then you get down to traffic impact studies, where these are related to capacity and really trying to determine when you need to do a project, the pace of development, and matching your project, your capital projects implementation with the pace of development. You get down to this level where you're looking 3 to 5 years out, and you're really trying to determine what are the existing and very near future operations of a facility. All of these processes need to be updated on a continual basis. That's what we do. We revisit our long-range transportation plan, whether we at the town or CHATS, every 5 years, and to validate either existing projects or identify new projects. And so, and of course, the traffic impact study is continually being updated as we do new projects. Talk a little bit about level service standards. In our long-range transportation plan, level service D is the standard, and that is for weekday traffic. And our impact fees are directly tied to the long-range transportation plan, which is based on level service D. So by default, all of our impact fees are based upon the level service D standard for weekday traffic.
Can you tell me what the state standard is while we're at this?
The state really doesn't. The state DOT, they don't really have a standard defined as well as we do.
But not level of service, but they have an intersection standard per se. Let's just say like a, do they have anything like that?
You know, I read through their guidelines for doing traffic studies in their manual, and it doesn't really identify a standard. It pretty much lets them have the autonomy of determining whatever they think it should be. So they could actually select a level service B or C if they wanted to. And we'll talk a little bit about why D, I think, is reasonable in a second. In most urban areas, most studies, even submitted to the DOT here, have a level service D. That's what you're trying to achieve, whether it be a design or operations. You're trying to, in an urban area, D.
So this, I just wanted to make the point known. So the state has no level of service identified, and we have many state roads within the town.
We do have many state roads. A large majority of our network is the state road. And I won't say they don't have standards. They may have planning standards that they try to achieve when they're looking out design-wise. But when I look at their impact, whatever they have for their impact analysis, maybe it's intentionally vague. I don't know. We have a standard. Most of the recognized standards for urban areas are D. Sometimes you get into E for other urban areas where E might be acceptable. For us, it's D. Once again, generally recognized as an industry standard for urban areas, and a lot of this relates to expectation. I think this makes a lot of sense. If you're in a rural area, you have a higher expectation of good flow. If you're out on a rural highway, you're not expecting to have curb cuts every 200 feet and traffic densities that you have in urban areas. A lot more activity in urban areas. Therefore, that relates to expectations. In a smaller sense, even when you start looking at delay for an intersection delay, it relates directly to expectation. And so this is kind of a micro example for an unsignalized intersection, just a stop sign. I pull up to a stop sign of a major highway. Level service D is defined as no more than 35 seconds. And that's because at a signalized intersection, where it's higher, 55 seconds, there's a reasonable expectation that the person's eventually going to be able to make their movement. So that's just a small example of expectation within level of service standards. And really, what it comes down to is what is practical and feasible. What is practical and feasible from an environmental standpoint? There's many different constraints. Environmental constraints, there's political constraints. Most of all, there's cost constraints. If you set a really high expectation of level service, I want to achieve level service B on a roadway. Well, B is very little delay. What would you have to do to achieve B? Most likely you're going to have a lot of capacity, lanes, whatever it might be, intersection improvements to achieve that. So that may be very unreasonable for both, for many different reasons, probably mostly cost. So for all these reasons, that's generally why people, you know, the industry focuses on this D for an urban area. The period analysis, we've talked a little bit about this. Why is the weekday generally considered the acceptable norm for operational analysis? And here are some points to make. Most land uses have their highest trip generation corresponding to the adjacent street. When that adjacent street peaks, they're peaking also. So all of the trip generation tables that we have relate to that adjacent street peak. And this makes sense from our economy standpoint. The work trip pretty much dominates the day, the commuter trip. In the morning, you have commuters home to work, you have school going on. In the afternoon, you have the same thing, plus you generally pick up your shopping purpose also. So for these reasons, that is why if you looked at what we call a K factor, if you took the 365 highest hours of any of all the days in the year, you'd find the curve would look something like this. It would go down and it would level out. And those first 30 are going to occur within that very short portion of the graph, because they're generally what we call outliers. The rest of the days, 330 some odd days of the year, generally represent the normal operating conditions of that roadway. So from a design standpoint, we use a 30th highest hour. For planning purposes, you use a 100th highest hour, something like that. So, and I don't have a graph to show that, but that's just a simple explanation.
So we don't build for a holiday?
Correct.
We don't build churches for, we don't look Sunday.
If you tried to design for those peaks, you'd be back into the situation we talked about where things become either environmentally
or cost,
you know, not feasible. And it would be the same idea if you set your level of service standard too high. That's going to be infeasible from many different perspectives. It doesn't even talk to the issue of getting into approvals of projects for land use. It's just roadway capacity. Majority facilities and majority hours in the year, the highest hourly volumes occur during this weekday period. And that's what you would see if you analyzed every single hour, the highest hour of the year on that graph I mentioned. And the weekday peaks represent reasonable peaks of activity without the outliers defining conditions and patterns. Once again, not that first 30 hours. It's remaining once it kind of levels out and starts falling off. And I'll talk a little bit about this, and this relates to a recent project on Ben Sawyer that I think everybody's familiar with, but it's relevant to the discussion because that was there's actually a count station there we can pull data from and start showing some of these concepts we talked about. So what I did, this data is representative of the green line is a Monday less than a month ago. And the brown line here is all the average of all preceding Mondays for the 3 months prior. So you see they pretty much match. So that day is pretty much mirroring what the historical average is. You have a little bit of a peak around 9 o'clock at this location. They're not all the same. Sometimes if you're in the north area, you might see this peak move back a little bit, which makes sense. People get out of their house a little bit earlier in an area if they have a longer commute. And then you actually see a little bit of a peak, less pronounced here in the PM, then it falls off.
What does the Google data give you that the current counters don't?
If y'all just hold your questions.
All right, so now let's look at, this is Memorial Day of last year. I don't have a word of the issue, obviously. But you can see the peak on Memorial, you don't even have the commuter peak, but the peak on Memorial Day is almost twice the average. Almost twice the average. So instead of in the 500, that's the peak of the average, in the 600 range, you're nearly at 1,200. So it's a good bit of difference on something like that. Now, no one's claiming that you should design a facility for Memorial Day, but if you start even talking about even less severe peaks, you could still be in that same position. And this was some information that was put together. Now, I didn't go through and confirm all 365 days that this engineer did, but this is relative to the discussion, and it also mirrors some information I've talked with Stantec one of our traffic engineers who's done the study for the IOP when they were looking at parking. When our, you know, we need to be looking at peak demand, things like that. So they look at traffic counts. And I already mentioned this, the peak on Memorial Day, twice out of the other Mondays. That's why, once again, we want to kind of look at that, at those other 330 days of the year. And here's a review. All the days basically had 33 days where traffic appeared to be heavier than the normal, that brown line, with directional peaks greater than typical commuter peaks, and 22 of those were on the weekend days. So that's not to say that there couldn't be differences, and obviously in the weekdays in the summer, and I did try to look at that a little bit, and I'll show you that here. One note, obviously the heaviest congested days during the summer, Memorial, well, here was New Year's Memorial and Independence Day, July 4th.
Polar bear plunge, I see.
Yes, polar bear plunge. That's actually, that would be it right there. Now let's look at, this is a Wednesday. Now when we do counts on either Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, because once again, if you look at historical data, Mondays and Fridays will have fluctuations that could be either high or low. You don't design too low. That's another point. You know, you don't want to have either an operational analysis or design that is actually going to underestimate what you'll see or what you need to design to. So here we have, I just picked the middle day of the week, the previous 3 months. This is, of course, that day. This day was a little bit less than the historical average, but generally it mirrors in very close in proximity. And this was trying to compare what is really kind of the summer or winter. Now I gotta get back. I'm gonna do that. The winter and the early spring before things start picking up, getting Memorial Day. And then what is the average looking like over the summer for a weekday? And what you see is in the morning, almost very similar. I'm taking one data point, but it's the data point of an average for 3 months, so it's probably going to be fairly close. Very close. And in the summer, yes. On Wednesdays, it appears that you have maybe about a 15 or 20% higher volume than the norm in that's what we call the school period that we typically count. All right, so that's a little bit about standards, why we have the standards, a little bit of the background, process-wise, what we go through is we go through for any traffic impact study we do. We look at what the land uses are proposed to generate. There's a book we have right here, several volumes of trip generation data from ITD. That's the national standard. That's what we choose. It's peak hour data. We also use that same reference for pass to determine how much of that traffic is it's not a new trip, it's something that's already on the road that's passing by and using it, and also internal capture. We consider approved developments, whether it's directly something that's already been approved that we add into an analysis, and typically we do both, because this is a little bit more of a conservative approach, is we have a growth rate we assume, and we look at traffic count stations, weekday counts, for those to determine a growth rate. And we take those trips, and based upon the land uses and existing counts that we know, how people are driving currently, peak directions, directionality of traffic, how turns are made in intersections, we distribute those new trips onto the network. We assume future improvements that are within a reasonable time frame. For instance, the traffic analysis just came through for Cambridge Square. We assume the roundabout. We'll have the roundabout constructed before the end of this year. That assumption would go into the analysis. Say you can make that assumption that the roundabout will be there. So we do that for all of our any capital improvement project that will be built within the horizon that we're looking at to build out the project. Level of service is based upon the highway capacity manual methodology. That's a wealth of information there based upon 60 some odd years of traffic engineering principles. That's the standard, highway capacity manual. We look at existing, no build, and build year analysis, meaning, okay, what is it now about any new traffic based on this development? What is the future year, and say 3 years from now, without any traffic from this development? And then we add the traffic development, say, what is the level of service with the traffic? And that's, those 2 years is what we really look at, the no build and the build, to say, development cause a deficiency to occur, meaning we go from acceptable level service D to an E or an F. And then we look at mitigation. Okay, if it does do that, how can we mitigate it? Whether that be at the site itself or even away from the site. Whether it be turn lane additions, or we need to add phasing to a signal, all the way up to, we've had developments have to widen roads because of that issue. So I guess that was it. I just wanted to give a basic overview of the process and the standards, and then however, Mayor, you wanted to proceed with that.
Well, thank you, Brad. I wanted the information for one thing, because, you know, we are obviously discussing the urban corridor. The Planning Commission is discussing the urban corridor. We're discussing the meets and bounds of the urban corridor. We're talking about transportation as a whole. I think there's lots and lots of conversation about transportation. I see Mr. William Hamilton here. Of course, you know, we don't talk about the other issues, you know, parking, true mitigation, widening Highway 41, you know, very long-term,
right,
you know, funding sources, public transportation, how that would alleviate, and beach traffic. And, you know, part of the reason I wanted to bring this up, and I don't want to beat it to death at this committee, I just wanted to have an understanding of it so the citizens would have an opportunity to listen and have an understanding of how we actually assimilate the information and how, you know, we make decisions moving forward. Just a couple questions. The highest use impact-wise would be commercial or residential?
Generally, the commercial use is going to generate more traffic at the site. That's a general rule of thumb.
Because that's going to be trips.
Correct.
More trips, not
right,
not more people.
Right.
More cars, just more trips,
right,
people coming and going.
Some of those are just people, once again, pass-by trip, already on the highway, come in, go out. They're not a new trip. But for new trips, yes, as far as attracting, that's one of the highest generators. Office use, obviously, something's a high trip generator. But retail is generally the highest.
And is there been a circumstance for mitigation that we've not been able to mitigate a project?
Yes. I mean, and the process is set up, once again, it's not a black and white. I mean, it says in our guidelines that just for the fact that something can't meet a level of service should not be the sole reason that you deny something. You need to consider something in totality. If a side street, which once again, you go to a side street, doesn't have a signal, and it's a stop sign, it's at a level of service D, and it adds 15 more seconds, it goes to E. Well, is that you know, are you going to deny a land use approval for that one thing? Probably not. I mean, that gets back to the expectation, particularly if the developer is having to mitigate other things, pay impact fees, and that's the way our whole system is set up, is we look at things, you know, you don't necessarily concentrate on one thing, but we have to look at the total picture. So. So yes, there are times where projects have been approved, understanding that, well, that may be a repercussion of that decision, but there's also they're doing this over here to offset that and mitigate that.
Okay, and then finally, for the 33 days or so that we've identified that there's extraordinary traffic, obviously, in the beach corridor, I mean, it's about 33 days, is that what I...
Well, once again, that was information that one of the professional engineers put together as it related to the Atlantic. It says, well, let's look at 300, I mean, he looked at 360, every day, 365 days at the count station, said, where does it come in above, you know, above the norm, extreme above the norm? And that's what he presented. I want to say again, that mirrors kind of what I've heard just talking with Stantec. So yes, that's generally understood. That's, once again, for a normal facility, you would see, if you look at data from a normal facility, you'd see that same curve, and that's why they use what we call that K30. You know, 30 is going to capture the majority of the operating conditions you would experience. You get it to the left side of that curve, when you start going way up, you're starting to design to the outliers and the extremes.
Okay.
So that's why it's reasonable, it's been determined reasonable to design to those standards.
And it might not sound reasonable to citizens who live in the Bensor corridor or mm-hmm. who live on the Alphonse Connector. Are there beach communities who have some different, is there a different type of review for those corridors?
I'm sure there are, and I guess what I would propose that we do is, you know, I talk about this process we're updating, is I could direct our consultant and say, let's look at that. Let's look at that specific issue. What are other areas doing about it? Is it reasonable? They may come out and say, well, it doesn't appear to be anything reasonably could be done based upon the conditions we're seeing. There's some practical difficulties with that, in that where do you stop trying to determine where beach traffic impacts things? I mean, is it just Ben Sawyer? Is it Coleman? You know, if you had a different process for something, that's something that you'd have to think about. That might be an unintended consequence. I got to tell the developer, well, you can't move forward because I need you to count in the summer, but you also got to count a weekend day, is what I'm saying. So those things need to be considered. I do think that you could probably, we could do this with our consultants, like, hey, what are other folks doing for this specific issue of beach-related traffic?
Right, because I mean, obviously, I didn't intend to solve it today. I intended to start a conversation.
Sure.
I intended to have an understanding of how we come to these issues. But as we are defining the urban corridor and density, absolutely, you would suggest that residential has less impact than commercial. So if you were looking at an area that was otherwise impacted for other things, perhaps a residential use would have a less impact than a
yes,
commercial
ma'am.
Or
there's
a retail use.
Right. If you look at these rates and you start comparing how much residential can I put on a property versus commercial and do the trip generation, the commercial is obviously going to be higher.
Okay. Those are great points. And that's all I had, because like I said, I wasn't looking to solve the problems of the world, but I just wanted to help Planning Committee, and as we move forward, the citizens understand this. Anything from the committee?
I had two quick questions. So Brad, are there ever instances or circumstances when we consider at certain intersections what other municipalities may or may not be doing? So say you had an impact of, you know, Daniel Island proposed some massive development, and we knew those came here, or the city of Charleston, somewhere near the bridge, knowing those folks might. I mean, do we ever consider what other municipalities are doing as far as density in any of our traffic studies?
It would generally be considered in how we would, like, if I'm looking at what assumption do I need to make on growth? That's kind of, I think, the basis of your question. Should I assume growth based upon some build-out of another area within a certain time frame? Well, our models kind of inform us of that, but more importantly, back at the traffic analysis process, it's the count stations that will inform us, like, okay, well, we're seeing a higher growth rate there because of that development. It's probably because of that development, we need to assume the higher growth rate that we're seeing. But what you're asking about generally occurs more on a higher level, and that long-range transportation planning level where the entire region has to be modeled. And we look at the interface of 40. What is R41 doing? What is Clements Ferry and 41 doing in Berkeley County? And the chat staff is going to be looking at that a lot closer than we are. But it is still being considered. That assumed growth is going to be considered in our modeling.
Let me phrase why I asked that question. I would suppose we have no control over how the city of Charleston develops or what its future density is. But inevitably, those folks are going to come to Folly, Isle of Palms, Sullivan's Island, go to the beach. Short of asking, walking around Sullivan's Island, so where did your trip generation begin?
Right.
How do we reasonably mitigate the density in downtown Charleston, and for what impacts that may have on traffic on Coleman Boulevard as it traverses toward Sullivan's Island? I can't begin to imagine how you would mitigate that, and whether or not that should ever figure into how we determine density in the town of Mount Pleasant is a completely separate conversation, but more of a curiosity about where these trips are generated from and how much control the town of Mount Pleasant has over where those trips begin. That, you know, let's say the College of Charleston says they're going to double enrollment, inevitably students there are going to come to Sullivan's Island, which means they'll drive down Coleman Boulevard. What can we do about that? And that's
a regional issue for sure.
It is.
And there's not much that we can plan to do for that. You know, these long-range plans do have external stations that they review. They actually try to determine what you're saying, where's your trip coming from and going to, but that's really for the whole urban area. It's not more detailed and defined as like, okay, was your trip from Charleston to the beach or here to the beach? We can only get that from modeling. We don't have any actual surveys to tell us that, but that'd be essentially what you'd be trying to determine if you went out to the beach, like where did your trip originate from?
Yeah.
And we could understand that better and plan for it, but lacking that information is very difficult. And once again, we don't control it.
Yeah, my second question, so, and I'm going to leave the school district, and one day they'll get way ahead in their planning for future schools, and I hope that happens, but, you know, right now, for enrollment, things like that, they rely upon our comprehensive plan, and that has to be what they do, and I suspect on some level their challenge has to be somewhat yours, and I don't know the answer to this question, but that's really what I'm asking it is. In the urban corridor overlay district, right now, let's suppose you plan on GDC staying GDC, but let's say tomorrow somebody comes in and proposes a development that, you know, potentially under underlying zoning, 16 units the acre, or let's say it's a boulevard phase four at 50-something units the acre. How can we reasonably plan for the unknown of what's in the overlay district and what could or couldn't come?
We do that in the sense that these long-range transportation plan models that we utilize both 25, 30 years or even interim planning, what we did when we looked at Coleman and the overlay district, is we make assumptions on redevelopment of properties, development of empty properties under the current guidelines at the time. So, for instance, when we did the traffic analysis for Coleman revitalization, we were modeling those increased densities at that time. Now, if that goes away, the next time we model it, we'll have a different assumption. But right now, we did assume those for that analysis.
So potentially, to piggyback off of that question, is that if the town of Mount Pleasant was to eliminate bonus densities altogether, it would be reasonable to assume that future developers would require less to mitigate future traffic if we took out bonus densities.
Correct.
Okay. That was my ultimate curiosity question.
To the degree that they could still, even under the normal operating non-bonus density, they could still trip something and cause something to fail, they still might have to mitigate it, but basically what it's going to mean is less trips into that work.
Yeah, so reasonably less cost to mitigate, presuming that there wouldn't be as dense of a structure as you went down the boulevard, that they would, it'd be easier for them to mitigate on a cost perspective.
Yes, that
would be a reason.
That's accurate, yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Birch?
Yes. Thank you for putting this on the agenda. It's healthy every now and then to get into the weeds and see just what Brad does and come to realize Brad does know what he's doing. And he does do a heck of a job. And I appreciate Brad staying in those weeds like he does. So I can just look at him and go, yeah, it works. And the other comments, I'm an optimist, but I heard you use the word, and I know I didn't take it the wrong way, but traffic, you're not going to solve it. It's what we all come to learn to live with, and that's it. That's why you said D. It's not about setting your standards lower, and also at the same time, we don't. If you've ever been on a planning committee for a church, you don't build it for Christmas and Easter. You know, so all those things come into play, and then also comment you just made about, well, if we eliminate bonus densities, then obviously we'll have less trips in that area. Then you leave that, then you get into good old cause and effect. Well, if I eliminated bonus densities for this, what did that trigger down the river? Well, if I took this bend out of the river, what's happening 10 miles out that way? What does it trigger? All those things are all interconnected and they're all swimming around. And, you know, I know Eric and Brad and Christiane, you're always paying attention to it. And your other question about, well, how about if Dandelion does this? Because, you know, we for years have paid very close attention to our friends at Ondo. And just what are they up to? You know, because, gee, we can annex and annex and annex and do these things, and we've got wonderful town Mount Pleasant to take advantage of. And that's a huge concern. But, again, I thank you for putting on the agenda. It's just healthy to see how you come around to these things and what goes into it to render a decision.
And it makes us makes it a lot easier for all of us to say we're not transportation engineers. Ms. Thomas, Ms. Stokes Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Thomas, Ms. Stokes Marshall, 481 Loop and Rebecca Lane. You may recall at our council retreat, I think it was back in January, or February, we talked about and reviewed traffic impact assessment. And one of the things I mentioned at that point in time was that the area where we live in, we have connecting municipalities, all of which are developing to some extent more so than others. And each one of those municipalities, as they bring on new development projects, in terms of the level of impact that their projects will have on the town of Mount Pleasant, roadways, whether the town owner, state owner, whoever, I mean, everyone's using these roadways. And it has been common practice, from my understanding, that the various municipalities, as they make their decisions concerning the traffic, the increase in our traffic by the increase in our population, we are not collaborating in terms of looking at the overall cumulative impact and effects of the developments of the surrounding municipalities that will all ultimately have an impact on the roadways, much of it here in the town of Mount Pleasant. And I'm sure most of us can remember when, at one point in time, the transportation plan was not a part of the town's comp plan. Council agreed and adopted and it became a part of the comp plan. As a result of that, as we move forward and looking at how do we address the increase in traffic, the need for road expansion, it's a touch and go, and it's a touch and go because it's not just the decisions that the town makes, but it's also decisions that the surrounding municipalities are making. And I believe Paul, you and the mayor had brought this up to chats where there was a meeting to discuss this, and there was some indication or feedback from that meeting that they would start looking at how they would approach that. Would you care to share with us?
Well, the chats, if you don't mind, ma'am.
Absolutely.
The chats group obviously is designed for the three counties that come together, and that group is constantly watching all those things you just talked about. They don't have any money. But, you know, we're watching those things.
We fight for what money is there, though.
Yeah, we do fight. So while they're, just like everything else, politics comes into play as to what can get attention. So while everybody's been talking about the extension of 526, or how do I widen 526, or how do we widen I-26, all those things with the big, big numbers, it's when we, you know, we started to realize that, well, the city of Charleston just approved 11,000 acres to do this, and they just approved that, and that's right across the river. And not to take us too far back, but a lot of the things that are on 41, Charleston County approved without our say-so. And they said, here, have at it. Great. So we said, Highway 41 is our single greatest challenge. And, you know, Linda and I spoke to the rest of the chat members and said, we've got to get together and do a collaborative corridor study. And where that is right now, as far as, I mean, I think Brad may be able to offer exactly where it is if you're asking that question, but that is in motion. Now, all along, while that's happening, everybody's trying to do everything they can on all sides to raise revenue, raise funding for that road project.
And thank you, Ms. Stokes Marshall, because this is not just about those issues. Obviously, it goes back to Mark's committee with economic development, because if we have true economic development and opportunities for people to work that are closer to their homes, we're not commuters. We do work, live here. We have buses we have to talk about. We have got to talk about light rail with Nexton coming to downtown Charleston, particularly that 75,000 people. And we are having those conversations at the COG. We are having those conversations at CHATS. We don't often bring it back to you, but, you know, it's Mark's job to get us a new economic development person, so that economic development person can say that these last properties that are left don't need to be residences, they need to be businesses, and they need to be opportunities for people to work at, like Huebner, that are paying $16.50 at their lowest rate, which, although $16.50 is not a ton of money, it's a pretty decent rate to have an entry level at $16.50. And it's Chris's job in planning to make sure that as developments come forward, we understand the mitigation. We can't fix it. At 55 seconds at a stoplight or 15 seconds at a stoplight at a D level is very acceptable. And, you know, we all become very quick-tempered and we want everything to be fixed. And as we further define the meets and bounds of the urban corridor and make the ultimate decision within the next couple of months about what's going to happen at Ben Sawyer, you know, it's going to be a decision that's based on what's best. Is it going to be perfect? No, it's not going to be based on beach traffic days, but it's going to be based on a collaboration of all these great committees of council, and then the full council as a whole, and then us at CHATS and us at COG fighting for the money to make it all happen. Yes, ma'am?
Okay, and you mentioned or brought me right into my next comment in reference to Colin Goldbart, especially going over to Sullivan Island with the beach traffic issue there. And I'm sure we've all gotten feedback and measurements in reference to the timing when the traffic study is being done in that area. And it does not take into account the peak hours and season for beachgoers and the impact that it has on that corridor, in addition to the fact that that bridge does open, you know, and it does feed into an overall congestion in that area, aside from the normal peak hours in the morning and in the evening in school time.
I understand. We've been living down there since 1964. I have a hard time on certain days. I get it. From the committee?
Thomasina, just to add also about CHATS, while it's a wonderful makeup of folks that are all over the three different counties, and they're all communicating, and sometimes it seems like they're not, but they are. But at the same time, every one of them is trying to do what they can in their own little turf. They're doing that, and the message is clear. I'm working with you, but I'm not making my decisions and what I'm doing in my municipality because of this, or this. We're going to do what we're going to do. It's like we've been told before. The schools can't even catch up. Wait a minute, I believe they've got a board of 9 elected officials over there. I'm not going to sit around and make my decisions, wait until after they make their decisions, you know. But we just have to be mindful of those things and just keep talking to each other. It's gotten a lot better, by the way, with that group.
Thank you.
My last question. In your efforts to work with COG to address the traffic increase situation in the Tri-County area, we know that there's definitely politics in play here. And the bottom line is money, okay? How much money can we get and where it's going to be applied, where it's most needed. And I'm sure each and every municipality thinks it's most needed in their communities. As opposed to just on the state level, is there any efforts by COG to try to reach up to the next level, the federal level, in an effort to help them understand the need here? I mean, people are not just saying that we're one of the fastest growing areas in the country. I mean, that's a fact.
Well, yeah, we garner those relationships, absolutely. And I reached out to Mark. I personally reached out to Mark Sanford's office last week to get an appointment to talk to him about federal funding for public transportation. So I think it's the duty of every elected official to continue to talk to anyone who can offer us funding at state level or at the federal level. And I know my councilmen do that. The CHATS and the COG, do they do that? But yeah, again, over there, everybody's fighting for every dollar that comes in, and we're scrapping for it. So, you know, and I have to give it to Brad again and to Eric for his leadership with the strategic plan. This municipality is better posed than most municipalities because we make pre-investment. We put our own money on the line so that we can get ahead and be ready when any monies might become available, because a shovel-ready project or some environmental study that's already been done certainly puts us further along the process. So I thank the staff for that. Yes, I saw you. I see you, Mr. Hamilton. I'll open up to some questions from the floor.
Just
Yeah, everybody said, talks about mitigation, you talk about development, I'll just pass those along. We can mitigate, we can develop, we can prosper, but we cannot take everybody everywhere all the time in an automobile. Right now, we have senior citizens in our community that are shut in their homes because after all the money we've spent on roads, and after all the money we've lavished on the automobile, at the ends of their lives, our senior citizens are afraid to take their cars out on these massive, swift roadways we built. The roadways that are better than D, the ones that never stop you, the ones that are fast and wide and exciting, that look like an interstate. They wall our senior citizens into their homes, and we can't find the money to match the funding to send a van to pick them up so they can socialize. So they're sitting there watching Jerry Springer on TV alone in their homes.
All right, now, William, you're not running for office. Come on, let's get to the point. William wants y'all to ride the Carter bus. That's the bottom line.
That's it.
Thank you. You like Jerry Springer? There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, this of course, is...
I'm just going to, because we're run way quick. Over.
I'm so almost done.
I'm not trying to shorten anybody, but we have run over.
You got to hurry. I got it. Obviously, they're talking about building a regional mass transit system, rapid transit system for our area. They're not talking about East Cooper as part of this plan. They want our votes. They want our taxes. They want our money. They want our cooperation. We're going to have to go to the table. The mayor knows about doing that. We know how to make transit work in Mount Pleasant. 300, currently the number of people riding the bus in Mount Pleasant is 308% of what it was in 2007. We have more than tripled our ridership, so we know what we're doing. I was out this morning visiting hotels.
Thank you, Wayne.
About Spoleto Sands Auto, which is where we get people to stay in our hotels for Spoleto and leave their money. And this lady at Red Roof Inn knows more about getting people to stay in Mount Pleasant in a hotel and ride the bus into town, which reduces our traffic, increases our tax revenues, and doesn't involve the death produced by the automobile. Her name's Patricia at the Red Roof Inn. Give her a call. She's the expert. Thanks for letting me shoot off my mouth. I know what y'all do is hard. I just tell you, the car is the problem, not the solution.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am?
We came to talk a little bit about Ben Sawyer specifically. Could we do that?
Absolutely. Do you have one representative who's here to speak on it? Or
we have several, but I'm going to start because mine is more basic.
Okay.
Is that a big packet? I don't know if anybody had any time to look at it. Do I need to?
Yeah, I have reviewed my emails, and we saw, yes,
okay.
I can't speak for my council.
We want to talk about Ben Sawyer specifically because it is so different, and I've had, Brad and I've had some conversations trying to figure out how can we measure it more accurately. The capacity number for Ben Sawyer is the typical number for a typical four-lane road. Half of that road, particularly from Rifle Range to the bridge, two-thirds of that road is only one lane. It's the causeway. And that back, on that side, going towards Sullivan's, it backs up traffic on the other third. So basically, that side of Ben Sawyer only functions as a one-lane road. And so the capacity number probably should be, on that side at least, for one lane. In other words, we're comparing capacity of a four-lane road to the actual functioning of volume of, you know, just this two lane. Furthermore, the counter, unless there's some secret counters out there, is on the causeway. That counter is measuring only what happens to be going and coming from Sullivan's Island. So all of our communities wouldn't get counted unless we're going to the beach. You know, Publix, the Bilo Shopping Center, it's not actually counting. So we're comparing the volume of a typical four-lane road with the volume of a two-lane road. So, you know, in addition, those counters only count what's moving. So when we have these slow down and these standstill traffics, it's measuring zero for that part of the hour. So you're getting an underestimated volume because it can't count what wanted to go there or what's sitting and waiting to go there. It only counts what went over the counter. And that's substantially lower than, the more congested it gets, the more inaccurate it is, because the less people can move. So the accuracy of the analysis is only as good as the underlying data. And we're saying that the capacity for that road is lower than a typical four-lane road. The bridge opens, the bridge people told us, average of 5 to 10 times a day. that significant reduction in capacity of that road, that would also have to be taken out. So we have these capacity overestimates and this volume underestimate because it's not counting the demand volume, the people that want to go across and are sitting in traffic. Is there, are there ways to measure this road much more accurately? It's distorted.
Well, I think that the counts are accurate. I'm not a traffic engineer, see, but I think they are accurate because they don't just count there, they count other places and it's all calculated, correct?
That's correct. And one thing that she's saying, it could be true, and we don't know this, is what is actual demand? Yes, the demand could actually exceed the count because in an hour you can't process
that.
But the counts, I do believe, are accurate.
The counts are accurate, but if you even look at the speeds, that's a 45-mile-an-hour zone. The speeds associated with these counts were 14 and 13 miles per hour for that hour. That means they were sitting still a good part of that hour. Nobody travels voluntarily 13 miles an hour over that pathway. So when you look at these counts, they're obviously undercounted because the traffic isn't moving. So I mean, Brad,
yeah.
I would echo you.
I hear your point, and like, again, I'm not an expert here, but I don't think we can build for demand. I mean, that's, I mean, you know, I understand your concern. I live in the corridor. I understand the challenges there. That's why I wanted to bring this up as we move forward with the design of that corridor. Yeah, I want to make sure that everyone is aware of these issues. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Paul Mount, 1481 Centipede Extension to Bay Club. I wanted to talk a little bit more about this methodology and following up on what you just said. You know, I'm not a traffic engineer either, but out of my own time, I've been studying this data because I study data for a living. This idea that there's only 33 days in a year that exceed normal, A, that's from a biased source. The people cruising the Atlantic wanted that number to be as low as possible. B, that means every weekend in the summer. That's a quarter of the year right there. That's actually a third of the year right there. Even if you just take 33 on its face, that's 10% of the year. That's more than just can be ignored. It doesn't rain here every day either, but that doesn't mean you don't put gutters on your house. You know, that doesn't mean that we don't have storm drains in. You do have to take into consideration not the standard model, but what actually happens on the road. And, you know, the highway capacity manual is very clear on that point, that you do have to take into consideration the things that actually happen on that road, the presence of the bridge, the volume of traffic that wants to go to Sullivan's. And, you know, I'll make this point too, that having higher densities along Bensler Boulevard has an outsized impact on the traffic in that region of town, because those people are living there because they want to go to the beach. They're going to go to the beach. And the line between traffic flowing and traffic not flowing is very small. We saw it work beautifully yesterday, but the week before, with only a couple hundred more vehicles per hour being counted, it was a complete standstill. We can't just ignore and pretend that that doesn't happen. That happens every week in the summer, and that's something, that's why all these people are here, right? It's not, oh, well, here's a cookie cutter thing, we're going to put it in. We live in this community because it's not a cookie cutter. We need to address it.
And that's why we're having the discussion. We appreciate that.
A question.
Can you get her name on the record?
Yeah, we didn't get your name on the record.
Lucy Gordon, 1551 Employers Boulevard. Brad, where, I know there's the count station out on the causeway. How, what other count station is used to measure the volume on Employer?
It's the count station I referenced. It's the one on the causeway. Is that?
You said that they were out of town.
No, and we're not going to turn this into questions for Brad, because honestly, we want to have this discussion as we move forward, so we have, so we can have honest discussion about the transportation issue down there, the traffic issue.
I guess the issue is it's not just the beach traffic. That counter on the causeway is not measuring the local traffic on Ben Sawyer, the communities. If there is another counter somewhere, I was just curious as to where that was.
Well, we count traffic.
And there is none.
But we capture data. We just did a Coleman Boulevard study. I mean, we capture data all the time. I mean, Brad doesn't make his decisions subjectively about one trip counter. He has to look at the community as a whole and consider the long-range transportation plan as we do. So we hear you, and like I said, that's what the reason we're having the conversation is that obviously this corridor is different, and we understand that this corridor is different. That's why we want to have the discussion. Thank you. Name and address for the record, Mr. Peggy.
Tom Peggy, 980 Lansing Drive. Two things. I just wanted to come here, put my name on the record, and say two things. One of which is that the 800-pound gorilla that no one takes a look at or admits in the room is the fact that Houston North got the road that was purposely built to cut, for traffic to cut through to 17 is broken. It's bottlenecked with those lights up there. I live on 980 Lansing, and I had a conversation with Gary Ponder about this. And I told him that. And I tell you this is purely observational science because I live on 980 Lansing. It really wasn't bad until those lights got turned on. And now we see commercial traffic. You don't see much commercial traffic. And when I walked in your office that first time, I walked in and I said, oh my God, you can see the problem from here. And I just wanted to be on record as saying, Houston Northgate is broken. It's causing stress on, that's where all this, most of the stress in my neighborhood comes from. And I'm sure it had an additional negative impact on Cottonwood Estates as well. Okay, Houston Northgate is broken. Look into it. Have your guys, if you pay $90,000, to look into that. The second thing is, earlier on when we were being tossed around as to we're going to do this, we're not going to do this, the rug gets pulled out. I went to the, actually, an officer came to my house because I had gone there and complained about the traffic. She said, what can we do to help? She was sincere, she was honest, she got to work, and she was, I asked her two things. Replace the 25 mile an hour speed limit signs, they're rusty, they're old, people don't know it. It's not just they're cutting through, they're racing through, they're texting through. I've got Brink's Banks truck, I've got this town of Mount Pleasant trucks cutting through, I've got UPS trucks cutting through, and you know why? Because I follow them. If I snag them down there, I follow them all the way through. So I can tell you this and be an honest man. Second thing is I asked that person, if this sign that's right across from Trader Joe's, which you can't see because there's cars parked in front of it, and that's such an incredible gauntlet to run anyway. I asked if this sign could be moved further down into the neighborhood where it would be obvious that you're in a neighborhood, there's children, watch children, trucks prohibited. I know there's no teeth in that wall, but at least we might fool a couple, okay? Gary told me that you can't put up signs like this because it encourages children to play in the streets. Does that hit anybody's, where it hit me?
We're going to get on there.
Yeah.
The signs that I grew up with, they're all over the place. It's still there.
Right.
They won't move it back to make it. Really, is that, I just want to know, is that a law?
I don't know, Tom. Thank you, though. I'll look into it. I'll let you know. Anyone else, Mr. Scurry?
Chip Allen, 961 Cove Bay Lane, Sawyer's Landing. There are a lot of figures out there, CHATS figures, COG figures, Department of Transportation figures, and they are very different. I've noticed the difference in traffic increase from year to year goes anywhere from 13.5% to 22.3%, depending on what figures you look at. So somehow or another, there's not one single source you can work with figures, but one thing for sure is the model of 2% per year increase that the SCDOT plugs in is just totally erroneous. I've been in real estate for almost 30 years in the Tri-County area. I've never seen an explosion that we're experiencing right now in the greater Charleston area, and it's gonna get worse. That 3-hour traffic jam between Sullivan's Island and Ben Sawyer Bridge a couple of weeks ago is going to be more and more common mainly because of the explosion of population all around the area. We added the Dewberry project behind Bilo. That is going to be another, people who live close to the islands are going to want to go to the islands. That's why they're probably residing there in the first place. So we have to do something. You know, I've been thinking about what to do. Do we need a staging area with buses? That could be an answer, especially during the months of, say, April through October. I think a blinking light to slow down the traffic in that rifle range, the Ben Sawyer corridor, just for 7 months out of the year might slow things down. My wife and I've never in my 30 years in real estate and I've traveled the whole Tri-County area. I've never had more difficulty getting out of a neighborhood. And I travel 30,000 to 40,000 miles a year, have been in my career. This getting out of Sawyer's Landing is the most difficult area I've ever experienced in my life. So I just think that something has to be done to change this, whether it be the staging, the buses used, or certainly backing off on the population allowances by cutting back densities. And for goodness sake, the character of that stretch from Life Range to Ben Sawyer Boulevard is unique. Solomon's Island is probably one of the hottest areas, I think, on the eastern seaboard. The restaurants rival the downtown Charleston restaurants. The beaches are probably as nice as any beaches around. And it's going to continue to be more popular with the Boeing crowd or the Volvo crowd or whatever crowd comes in with the increased businesses. So something's got to be done. I think you're working in that direction. And the new comprehensive plan and the reduction of the bonus densities goes a long way towards helping that situation out.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. This was an item that we were going to just give review and consideration of as we move forward in helping define what's going to happen in that corridor. So I appreciate you all for your time, and I appreciate for all the rest of the council that's here for listening to these issues. We have consideration. It's my understanding that Peaceful Way wants to be paved, and we have a way to pay for it, and it's $75,000, and 100% of the people that live on the street want to have it paved.
I couldn't put it more succinctly.
What is the favor of the committee?
What you need from us?
We would need a motion for council to recommend that be added to the TST, the sales tax projects, because there is a specific allocation for paving the streets.
I move as stated by the traffic engineer.
Second. I got a motion and a second. And Paul, this is very much thanks to you and these citizens. We do hear citizens. Citizens reach out to council members and committees. And this is the way it works. So thank you for getting this on there, and we're going to get it paid for. All in favor?
No, I'm just glad that, you know, because before, not everybody was unanimous to have it paved, and now they got it, and
the citizens want to pave, and we're going to pave it, and that's awesome. I would suggest that the update could be just given for the record. Thank you very much. Is there anything else to come from award this committee? Y'all get on the bus.
I've got the bus for Ben Sawyer. It's a nice ride downtown.
Chris,
very stressful. I like this work.